Black Agenda Radio with Glenn Ford and Nellie Bailey, Mondays at 4 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, analysis, and commentary from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford. My co-host Nellie Bailey is busy organizing this week. Coming up, is President Obama's jobs proposal mostly a Republican trickle-down scheme? A noted economist says he could put all the nation's unemployed back to work at a cost of only $300 billion. And an esteemed black whistleblower says the only honorable thing for Obama's environmental chief to do is resign, now that her boss has backtracked on pollution controls. But first, this weekend marked the 40th anniversary of the bloody assault on Attica State Prison, where Governor Nelson Rockefeller's gunman killed 32 prisoners and 11 guards. New York City's historic Riverside Church marked the occasion with 2 days of commemorations. Among those on hand was Elizabeth Fink, one of the lawyers who won an $8 million judgment against the state of New York for the mass torture of inmates in the wake of the rebellion. She talked about the legacy of Attica, 1971.
What Attica talked about, and the reason why it still resonates to today, was the human rights of people. And what Attica really showed was the human rights and the humanity of the prisoners as juxtaposed with the inhumanity and viciousness of the state. And that's the other reason why people should look at what happened in Attica today. Because the state had no reason to fire a shot at Attica. And they could have taken the yard, the CS gas that was dropped, incapacitated everybody. And at the time the CS gas was dropped, they mowed everybody down. The reason why they did that was to show what happens when you rebel. Now what has happened is that they have used the prison system as the way to incarcerate any possibility of dissent in this country. What Attica talks about is the crisis, and that is a paramount issue in America today. Our morality, the effectiveness of our society, is totally undermined by the prison industrial complex and by the number of people who are in prison. 60 to 70% of those people don't belong there. They believe in vocational trainings, they belong in educational trainings, they believe in drug treatment, they believe in mental health treatment. But rather than have that, because there are no jobs, and there's nothing because of the structure, which is not based in humanity, right, people are incarcerated, and it's an enormous crisis. All the money that's spent in incarceration, the vast quantity of people, more than any other country in the world, could be used to revitalize the economy.
Some have described mass incarceration as being or resembling a counterinsurgency program.
Oh, absolutely. I think that what people have to understand is that Cheney and Addington and Rumsfeld and all those people, they grew up at the same time I grew up, in the 60s. And they watched this revolutionary period, and since they were the ruling class, the rulers, they wanted to figure out how to take it down. And so that's what they did. First, they created a national highway system with belts around the inner city so they could seal it off in the time of rebellion. Then they decimated the marijuana crop and changed the fact that you could get marijuana from $20 an ounce and it would cost you $100 an ounce for cocaine and heroin, and changed it all about so that now it costs $400 an ounce for marijuana and you can get heroin and cocaine for $20 a gram, where it used to be 100, and saturated the community with crack, supplied by we know who, and then watched it and incarcerated it. So it's totally counterinsurgency.
Mass incarceration seemed to spread universally across the United States in a very, very short period of time. How was the phenomenon so uniformly explosive?
Well, I think that it all started in Reagan. They started out with the welfare cheats, and then, as I said, they saturated the community with crack. And then, having done that, they then created these laws which made the sentences absolutely draconian. After all, let's not forget the first of the draconian sentences was Rockefeller, right after Attica. And what people don't know about the Rockefeller drug laws is that the first of them said that if you took methadone, you could avoid some of these penalties. And there were people who did power structure research in those days, and they found that the company, Eli Lilly, was really owned by the Rockefeller brothers. That's how gross it is. By the time the Reagan years, and then there was a repeal of the bail in the Bail Reform Act of 1984, and then the ultimate was in 1986 and 1987, in federal court, there were the guidelines which took the power of sentencing away from the judge and gave it to the government, to the prosecutors. And at the same time, in states like California, have the three strikes you're out laws, and in Texas. And so everybody gets incarcerated. By the time 1988, it was so in passed, right, you know, first in the federal system and in the states as well.
President Obama has not even given lip service to alleviating America, a great deal of pressure coming from black elected officials.
Well, it's the same thing as like the war. No one talks about, you know, they talk about this economy crisis, and no one talks about that if they would come stop having these imperialist wars, their economic problems would be solved because they could take all that money that they spend every day and use it to pump up the economy, to fix the roads, to reestablish the National Health Service, to do all the stuff that this country needs. It's falling apart. Fix the levees.
40 years after Attica, do you see any indications of a movement against mass incarceration?
Yes. I think that for the first time, everybody is understanding the cost of mass incarceration is enormous, and it's taking an enormous toll out of America, and that it needs to be addressed. And that it's so much cheaper to put someone in rehab than it is to incarcerate them. The conservative movement is even finally coming around to seeing that there has to be done, something done about mass incarceration. But the power that structure doesn't. And also, the other thing about it is it's a total way to appease the white working class. Here, we'll give you a prison.
As a place of employment.
Right, you bet. You know, upstate New York, I mean, when Cuomo, when he first came in, he vowed to shut the prisons. And the guards union, which is incredibly powerful, the only thing the state learned from Attica is the guards union learned that they were fodder. And the state would murder them with impunity, which they did. And so they created this, I don't want to tell you how evil it is, right, that has incredible amount of power. Just fabulous amount. And he says they should shut prison down. They should shut Attica down. Make it into a museum. The state of New York would get a lot of money. Look how much the federal government makes on Alcatraz, especially what Attica looks like. You know, you could have buses take your tour of the yard. You could still see the bullet holes. They're still there. So when it came time to announce what prison he was shutting, the prisons he was shutting were the prisons in New York City. Arthur Kill in Staten Island, Fulton in the Queens. I mean, it was outrageous.
And these are the prisons that are close to the families of the people being
held. Exactly right. Exactly right. But I hope that the example of what happened in Attica, which is a watershed in American history, again, can galvanize people to do what has to be done, and it's just to form a movement and end this absolutely outrageous counterinsurgency program of the ruling class.
Attorney Elizabeth Fink, speaking from Brooklyn, New York. President Obama shocked and enraged environmentalists when he abandoned his administration's plans for tougher air pollution controls in the face of Republican and big business opposition. Instead, the president will stick with the old pollution standards from the Bush era. Marsha Coleman Adebayo is a renowned whistleblower who once worked at the Environmental Protection Agency. She says it's up to the people to defend the air that we all breathe.
President Obama has taken his position. The EPA Administrator, Lisa Jackson, has taken her position. Members of Congress who have failed to speak out against this have also made their position known. And I think now it's basically back in the court of the American people. And the fundamental question that we have to ask is, what are we going to do? And the reason why that's a fundamental question that we have to ask ourselves is because we are the ones who are really going to be impacted by President Obama's decision to ask the EPA administrator to stand down on something as basic as the air we breathe. Last week, Senators Ben Cardin and Barbara Boxer, before the president made his decision, sent out an email to their constituents. And there were a couple points that are really worth noting here. One is that the senators make the point that unless the president signed this, the amendment to the Clean Air Act, that by 2020, we could expect more than 230,000 early deaths. We could expect 120,000 emergency room visits. We can expect 2.4 million asthma attacks, and we can expect 200,000 cases of acute heart attacks. Now, the American people have now been sacrificed on the altar of political expediency by this president. And the fundamental question we have to ask ourselves, what are we going to do? Before the president made his decision, not 24 hours before he made his decision, Lisa Jackson, the EPA administrator, had penned an article for Huffington Post called Telling the Truth About the Environment and Our Economy. And what she said was very revealing. She said, you know, the EPA has worked very hard with industry leaders, and we have now come to a consensus with energy leaders. And she says, these regulations, the amendment to the Clean Air Act, will not kill coal. Up to 50% of retirements, that's retirement of coal plants, are due to the current economics of the plant due to natural gas and coal prices. And she goes on to say that a lot of these industry leaders have now acknowledged that working with old technology and really dirty technology is not even economically efficient for them anymore, that they need to invest in these plants and provide scrubbers on these plants so that they can burn coal more efficiently. I think that's a little strange because it's like talking about dry water or talking about clean coal. But nevertheless, she had come to some agreement with industry people to say that they're prepared to move their plants to something that's a little bit more efficient. So what is the final decision? And so why did President Obama do it? If it wasn't because of the industry, if clearly he wasn't listening to the scientists, he wasn't saying that the scientists disagree that we needed new standards. In fact, the scientists are saying, yes, we desperately need new standards. So the only thing that's really left for us to really consider, I think, is he asked the EPA administrator to stand down based on political considerations. So he's literally put our lives on the altar for political expediency, and I find that despicable.
President Obama's people will tell you he did it for jobs.
And what I would say is that if you can't breathe, you can't work. In other words, according to Senators Cardin and Boxer, and because of this the science that we know about in terms of air pollution, that we're going to have hundreds of thousands of people who are going to have upper respiratory breathing problems. If you can't breathe, you can't work. So what's the point of keeping all this old technology in plant, less efficient technology in plant, if you have a sick workforce? It just absolutely makes no sense. And so this was clearly a softball that he sent over to the ultra-right wing of the Republican Party, not even to industry anymore. This was simply a softball to the Tea Party and the people who are going to pay for this dismissive policy towards their health will be, in particular, poor people, because those are the communities that are closely situated to sites of pollution. So Black and Hispanic people are the ones who are really going to pay for the decision by the Obama administration. And in particular, the president himself, not just his administration, but this was President Obama's decision to delay these standards.
You won much acclaim for your work around clean air issues during your stay with the Environmental Protection Agency. You're a kind of heroine in the environmental movement. How has this decision by Obama affected his support among environmentalists?
I must give you some good news, and this is really important, is that Senator Boxer issued a statement yesterday in which he is encouraging the environmental movement to file a lawsuit against the White House. So I think we're beginning to see a crack in this armor with between the Democrats, who until now have been unprepared to criticize the president. So Boxer yesterday issued a statement saying that she would support environmental groups filing a lawsuit against the White House. But the question in my mind is, what is Administrator Jackson going to do? Now, around 2005, 2006, former Governor, EPA Administrator Chris Whitman was in a very similar situation where the Bush administration had told her to delay air quality standards, air pollution, clean air standards. And what did she do? She stepped down. She stepped down. She showed that she had some commitment to the environment, that she had a moral core, that she wasn't going to allow this to happen on her watch. How wonderful to see someone with at least a moral core. Now, she said in her letter of resignation that she was stepping down because she wanted to spend more time with her children or watching the grass grow, whatever. But a couple of years later, she actually issued a statement, or she said in an interview, that the real reason why she stepped down was because she could not stomach, she could not be a party to an administration that was going to roll back clean air standards. So now the question is also, I think, posed to Administrator Jackson, and that is, what are you going to do? And I'd like to throw out a challenge to EPA Administrator Jackson today, and that is, blow the whistle on Mr. Obama. Blow the whistle on him. If you believe what you wrote in the Huffington Post, then I would ask you, blow the whistle. Blow the whistle. And it's interesting, now that she is in a position that so many other EPA employees find themselves in, of being in a situation where there is a conflict between your conscience and what you're called upon to do to save your job. And she has a whole team of attorneys at the EPA who go after whistleblowers on her behalf, on behalf of the agency. Now she's in a position where the administration has told her to shut up, like they told me to shut up so many years ago on vanadium poisoning. I want to know, what is she going to do? Does she have the same courage that so many other EPA whistleblowers have exhibited in that agency? I want to know if perhaps this is her Rosa Parks moment. Perhaps if she steps down now and she's clear about why she's stepping down, maybe she could save the lives of these hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of people. Maybe this is the point where she steps up to her place in history. So let's see what she's going to do.
Marsha Coleman Adebayo was instrumental in winning passage of the No Fear Act in 2002. That legislation was designed to protect whistleblowers from retaliation by the federal government. Her new book is entitled No Fear, A Whistleblower's Triumph Over Corruption and Retaliation at the EPA. We're proud to say that Black Agenda Report will be publishing parts of that book. President Obama offered a joint session of Congress a grab bag of proposals to bring down unemployment. The mix of business incentives, tax breaks, and construction spending comes to about $450 billion. We asked Doug Henwood, editor of the Left Business Observer, for his assessment of the Obama jobs plan.
Well, I guess it's better than nothing, but it certainly shows the efforts to be conciliatory. I guess the fact that there is even any kind of jobs bill or stimulus bill is a little victory of sorts, but what's in the thing is not the most effective forms of stimulus, let's say. It's certainly a good idea to extend unemployment benefits, and it's a decent idea maybe to experiment with using unemployment system to top off salaries when people go on short hours, but extending the payroll tax break will give people, I know, 25 or so extra dollars a week, which is not nothing, but certainly not enough compared to what they need. And it has a decent but not spectacular economic kick. The business tax breaks, there's really not much to those. Businesses hire when they think they've got some strong demand ahead of them, and no business thinks it's got strong demand ahead of it except maybe the repossession business. So there's not going to be much hiring, and tax breaks have very, very little effect on whether businesses hire or not. So that's just gravy. And certainly medium and large businesses have quite a lot of cash. It's not like they're short of funds. Their corporate profits are very strong. The corporate balance sheets are full of cash. They're just not spending it. They don't want to hire. They don't want to invest. They're afraid of the future, and they're giving a lot of it to their shareholders. So it's not a lack of cash that's causing businesses to refuse to hire.
The right is always charging that the left wants to throw money at problems, but it appears that they want money thrown at businesses, and that the president agrees with them.
You know, a friend of mine said years ago that the rich don't want to pay taxes anymore, they want to be paid tribute, and I think she really had a point. That's the drift of policy. Get taxes down as close to zero as possible for the very rich, And if possible, give them some free money. The Federal Reserve is giving banks free money to help stimulate the economy. The government gave a lot of businesses free money in the form of a stimulus package. They certainly like to get money thrown at them.
Do you anticipate that even this very modest bill will be cherry-picked?
Well, the Republican strategy has been to just say no to whatever Obama proposes. He makes every effort to conciliate with them. He's like a master of preemptive compromise. Yet they always say no. You'd think that even if he offered to embrace their entire agenda, they'd say no, it's not enough. Now, from what I hear and understand, this is their deliberate strategy. They want him to do as badly as possible, and they figure that they can benefit from it. And that's all they really care about, is that cynical political calculation. A former Republican staffer who wrote up a piece in Truthout, Mike Loughlin, told me that this is part of their strategy. They think that if government looks bad, they benefit because they're the anti-government party. So they just want to block everything and say no to everything. Yet it's striking how Obama never really made any kind of political break with the previous administration in economic terms or in foreign policy terms, for that matter. Never really articulated a new path, and then for that reason has a very, very weak political foundation. And I think the problem is that he fundamentally agrees with imperial neoliberalism. He has no problem with it. He's an enthusiastic proponent of it. In some ways, in foreign affairs, he's intensified Bush administration policy. So all these people who wonder why he lacks backbone and strength and all that sort of thing, I think are underestimating the degree to which he is a fairly center-right politician. I mean, he's facing an extremely insanely right-wing party, but, you know, he's no progressive himself.
Doug Henwood, editor of Left Business Observer. Randall Ray is a professor of economics at the University of Missouri in Kansas City. He says the economy must create 300,000 new jobs per month, every month, for the next 5 years, if there is to be a recovery. But the Obama plan is not projected to create more than 1.5 million jobs in total, far too few to put the country back to work.
At best, the Obama jobs plan is going to give us 5 months worth of what we need, and then it's going to run out, just like the stimulus package, the original one of $800-900 billion, ran out, and then the economy faltered, lost steam, and we're back into a double dip. That's what's going to happen.
Now, there was a time when hundreds of thousands of jobs per month were created, wasn't there?
The Clinton years. And yes, we hit 300,000 jobs a month during the Clinton years.
And there was a time previous to that, during the New Deal.
Oh, yes. During the New Deal, we created jobs for 13 million Americans. And, of course, our nation is much bigger now. What we need now is 20 to 25 million new jobs. A new New Deal program could certainly do that. President Roosevelt created 13 million jobs in a situation even more dire than the one we've got now. And we recovered jobs at a much faster pace during the 30s, Great Depression, than we are under President Obama. If we continue at the pace that we've had in this so-called recovery, it's going to take us 9 years to get back to where we were in 2008, just in terms of the number of jobs. In the Great Depression, we actually regained all of the jobs that were lost after the crash in 1929 within 7 years. The pace was much better, and the New Deal was the difference.
And you recently wrote a piece that stated that you believe that you could create sufficient jobs to pull the country out of this with only $300 billion.
Yeah, that's right. And in fact, that would be the gross spending. If you just do the calculation, let's say $20,000 per year, 15 million jobs, you're at $300 billion. But that's the gross cost. That doesn't count any savings you would get from unemployment compensation. You'd probably get about $150 billion reduction of unemployment compensation. So that brings the cost to half of $300 billion. You also get a saving on food stamps, welfare payments. You get a saving on crime. You get a saving on incarceration by creating jobs. So really the net cost of a New Deal jobs program is going to be very, very low. And we would be solving the unemployment problem and creating 10 times at least, 10 times as many jobs as Obama's plan will do for $450 billion. And this might sound incredible. How can you do that? The reason is because Obama's plan basically really is, let's use supply-side economics. Let's try to increase business confidence. Let's give businesses some more tax cuts. Let's try to improve the outlook of the rich, and then maybe they'll create a few jobs for people. The Roosevelt method was completely different. He said, no, let's create the jobs directly. That will improve business confidence because sales are going to go up, and then businesses will finally start hiring again. The Obama plan is, let's try to convince businesses to hire people even though they don't have sales. It's very expensive to do it that way.
Obama's infrastructure bank seems to try to mimic the language of the New Deal, but it looks like a business-driven kind of initiative.
Now, I have to admit I'm not familiar with the details of that plan, but in the New Deal, we got the Reconstruction Finance Corporation that directly financed activities, and it also refinanced mortgages. We also need that, of course, and I don't know, maybe the Obama administration will finally get around to helping homeowners. We need to refinance all the mortgages. The previous Obama plan to help people with mortgages they couldn't afford, we know it was just an absolute complete failure. What we need to do is refinance all of them.
There are elements of labor that applauded that plan. One would expect labor, understanding what happened in the New Deal, that they would be demanding the kind of public works type of approach that you've been talking about.
The problem is, I think, that they are just too defeatist. They don't see a way to get Washington behind that. If you've got a president that is not pushing that, and you've got a Republican Party that has no interest in recovery, I would say at least until the last few weeks, they've had no interest in recovery. They saw their political fortune in continued recession. They want the population to be upset at the president and the Democratic Party, and so the worse the economy, the better they thought their political prospects. So in that environment, I think the labor unions just believe there's nothing that can be done. I think they're wrong. I think they should be pushing Obama. They should be making it clear that Obama will not be supported by labor in the next election unless he comes up with a real jobs program. And this one, unfortunately, is not a real jobs program.
Professor Randall Ray of the University of Missouri. Veteran political activist David Swanson, who runs the influential website War is a Crime, has an idea for how a progressive candidate could challenge Obama in the 2012 election without being accused of being a spoiler for the Republicans.
Should such a candidate materialize or be persuaded to jump in, and it's not me, and as far as I know, it's not you, although if you want to, I'll back you, it will be up to them, right? I mean, this is a formula that works for any candidate, but my off-the-cuff suggestions were these eight conditions. President Obama withdraws all troops from Iraq and Afghanistan by October 2012. President Obama rejects the tar sands pipeline. President Obama permits the EPA to enact the clean air standards it's attempting. President Obama vetoes any legislation that would extend the so-called Bush tax cuts for the wealthiest 10%. President Obama creates no more corporate trade agreements. President Obama vetoes any legislation that further increases the military budget or fails to reduce it by at least 10% a year. President Obama vetoes any legislation that would in any way reduce Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid benefits. And President Obama publicly instructs the Attorney General to enforce our laws against torture and warrantless search and seizure. Obviously, that's a list that could be altered, shortened, lengthened. But the beauty of the idea, I think, is that you could have a challenger, whether primary or general, who would be asked all the usual nonsense spoiler questions and would be able to quickly both dismiss them and turn the topic of conversation to policy issues on which people need to be educated. So the response would be, I'm not spoiling anything. I'll be delighted to drop out. The president just has to meet these simple few requests that come from the majority of the public, not just me, and then I'm gone.
It seems also to be a challenge to those who are talking about why isn't there a challenger to face their own trepidations.
Right. I mean, conceivably, there are people who would like this idea because they would think it would persuade their hero, Obama, to finally do these things that it's in his power to do. And you'll note that I've listed only things that are exclusively in his power. They don't depend on the Congress or the media or foreign nations or anything else. So whether you think that there's a snowball's chance of Obama doing any of these, whether to improve his election challenges or for any other reason or not, this is an idea to get an incredibly valuable platform for educating and organizing the public around these issues. So the conversation wouldn't be about the Electoral College or state opinion polls, prediction successes, or how to not be a spoiler. The conversation would be about how all of our money is going to billionaires and wars and we're destroying the environment, or whatever the conditions might be that such a candidate would place on withdrawing from the race.
And that's a very interesting approach. The apologists for Obama are continually saying, well, he had to take this action. The Republicans forced him to take that action. Or alternatively, he can't do this because the Republicans won't let him do this. But all of your points are things that he can do and the Republicans can't stop him.
Yes, absolutely. That's why I think it was a good development this past week to see so many former Obama supporters getting arrested by the hundreds in front of the White House, because it was over an issue that is tar sands pipeline, over which he has complete power in the hands of that single individual. Now, whether we should have ever given a single individual such powers is a whole other question, but he has them. And so I think the conditions that should be set on such a candidate withdrawing should be just those, things that Obama can do. So it's not that the Bush tax cuts end for the super wealthy. It's that he veto any bill that continues them. And if his veto is overridden, he still met the condition. But he is, of course, not at the moment expected to take these sorts of actions at all. And so this would be a means of making him do it, as he supposedly has asked us to do, right? He could point not to the Republicans, but to this serious, well-funded, progressive, majoritarian challenger and say, so-and-so is making me do it.
And removes one more layer of illusion from those who still have such illusions about the president.
This kind of a candidacy would avoid the whole spoiler discussion, but that doesn't mean it's likely to win. But whether it would win or not, it would be of incredible value in educating people, people who are involved in politics in any way or not, Obama supporters and Republicans and those who are tuned out alike, to what the major issues are. Because nobody has any idea that half our money is going to the military. Nobody has any idea that the president can reverse these kinds of policies if he chooses to. It's a means of awakening a movement.
And of course, I must ask you, do you have any favorites out there as an alternative standard bearer?
Oh, well, there are hundreds of worthy candidates. It's a question of who is willing to get in and who has the kind of name recognition and, sadly, fundraising ability to make it credible and viable and get over that hump of defeatism. And I set up some weeks back a website called StopHoping.org that lets people vote on who their favorite challenger might be and to nominate more. The winner, last time I checked, it's been a while, was Bernie Sanders. But there are dozens and dozens, and there are some very good, talented people who I know are quietly having this discussion of, should I run, but only run in the non-swing states, and run, but if it gets close and it looks like a Republican might win, back the Democrat in those states, or maybe we could have people in the safe states swap votes with friends in the non-safe states and the rest of it. And these are very well-intended people contemplating such a strategy. My fear is that that kind of campaign would just produce a discussion about spoilerdom, and it would never shift the conversation on our televisions or in our newspapers to to the platform issues that would be motivating the campaign in the first place.
David Swanson, speaking from Washington. The International Criminal Court calls Libya's Muammar Gaddafi a fugitive. The ICC has charged Gaddafi with crimes against humanity. But the relatively low number of fatalities during demonstrations just before the armed revolt against Gaddafi's government pale in comparison to the widespread murder and ethnic cleansing of black Africans, including black Libyans, by NATO-backed rebels. In terms of the mandate of the International Criminal Court, the rebels' crimes against black people may be far more serious than those that have been leveled against Gaddafi. We sought out the opinion of Francis Boyle, professor of international law at the University of Illinois in Champaign.
Well, that's correct. And you'll note the United States and France and Britain were very careful in their resolution of referral to the International Criminal Court to exclude all the crimes that they might commit beforehand. So this is really a joke and a fraud. And indeed, the ICC has become nothing but an imperialist tool by white racist Western colonial states to go after tin pot dictators in Africa of color, whose crimes are minimal compared to the monstrous crimes committed by the United States, Britain, France, not only in Libya but elsewhere.
Would the United States, Britain, France, the whole of NATO, be liable for ethnic cleansing committed by their Libyan surrogates?
Certainly under the principle of command responsibility, yeah, I would think so. But again, it's not going to happen at the International Criminal Court. They knew in getting the Security Council resolutions, and we've discussed this before, they were just going to bomb the dickens out of Libya and exterminate Libyans. And so they shrewdly removed themselves from the jurisdiction of the ICC for anything they do in Libya. So there's really nothing that can be done there at the International Criminal Court. It's total hypocrisy and double standards, and just shows that despite its promise when it was founded, the ICC has just become another imperialist tool for these white Western racist colonial genocidal powers to be used against people of color in the third world, and now especially in Africa.
What legal forums are available?
As it stands now, if Colonel Gaddafi could appoint me their permanent representative and ambassador at United Nations headquarters in New York, I could try to sue these states at the International Court of Justice in The Hague and get a temporary restraining order for them to cease and desist from bombing Libya. Right now, Libya does not have a UN ambassador. The United States government has illegally prevented Libya from sending an ambassador over here in violation of the UN headquarters agreement. So as it stands now, unfortunately, nothing can be done. I regret to say that lawsuits here in the United States are a waste of time. Ramsey Clark and I already sued Reagan, Thatcher, and the rest of them for bombing Libya back in 1986, and we lost, and Ramsey was sanctioned, which is outrageous.
This seems to be another trophy in the responsibility to protect exhibition after Haiti. Is responsibility to protect a recognized legal doctrine?
No, it isn't. As a matter of fact, if you read the General Assembly resolution on responsibility to protect, they make it quite clear it had to conform with the terms of the United Nations Charter. So what we're seeing here is just total baloney, not only in Libya, but also in Haiti. As you know, in Haiti, the United States government just decided, under Bush Jr., just decided to invade Haiti. That was it. Their consent wasn't asked for at all. They just invaded Haiti. And now the poor Haitians continue to suffer from this.
Colonel Gaddafi is described in the corporate media and by Western governments as a fugitive. Legally, what is his status?
Technically, right now, Colonel Gaddafi is the head of state of a UN member state, which is also a member of the African Union. And he is protected from murder and assassination under the New York Convention. And until that situation has changed, that is his status. The African Union has refused to recognize this rebel government in Libya. And as of today, the rebel government in Libya does not represent Libya at the United Nations either. So until there are changes here, he's still the head of state. He abjured any title to become president. He set up the Jamahiriya, State of the Masses, which everyone has made fun of. But I've been over in Libya three times, spent a sum total of 5 weeks over there. I've seen the Jamahiriya system in operation. I think it's a pretty good system to bring together a country that effectively consists of Bedouin tribes, and it sort of had operated on that principle. So Gaddafi's technical title is leader of the revolution, but he's still head of state.
The United States is always talking about the international community. I thought the African Union was also part of the international community and especially relevant to Africa.
That is correct. Under the terms of the United Nations Charter, the African Union is the relevant regional organization set up under Chapter 8 to deal with the entire situation in Libya. And the United States and the NATO powers have completely illegally displaced and supplanted the African Union, the role that they are supposed to play, and simply arrogated to themselves the power to intervene here. The African Union, as you know, has a roadmap for peace in Libya that's simply been illegally brushed aside by the United States and the NATO powers. So it's just a shameless exercise of raw, naked, brutal force by these Western colonial imperial powers. Look at it this way. NATO here, this is the axis of genocide. Look what the United States has done to its Indians, Canada. Look what Belgium and France have done to Africans. We can go down the list. Turkey to the Armenians, the Dutch to Asians in Indonesia. If you just go down the list of these NATO powers, they've committed mass extermination. Germany, give me a break. Italy exterminated half the population of Libya. I was over there one of my trips, and they had a museum dedicated to documenting the Italian Holocaust against the Libyans. And it reminded me a bit of Yad Vashem over there in Jerusalem, though on a smaller scale. And I spent a day there with the curator going through all the documents and pictures and everything. And at the end of the day, I said, so in other words, the Italians committed genocide on you. And he quietly said yes. So all these Western colonial white racist imperial powers are genocidaires. They've committed genocide before, whether in Libya or Africa or elsewhere in the world. And it's just a sick joke and a demented fraud to believe that they are over there under some bogus doctrine of responsibility to protect or humanitarian intervention. They are over there to steal all of Libya's oil and gas, and in addition, to reestablish military bases, Western military bases in Libya, that they can use to control and dominate all of North Africa, the southern Mediterranean, and then to project more power further south into sub-Saharan Africa, Black Africa.
One wonders if that museum to the Italian Holocaust in Libya will survive under the new NATO order.
Certainly, if Italy gets in there, they'll destroy it, because Colonel Gaddafi had threatened legal action against Italy over the Italian genocide against the Libyans. But then there was a settlement with Italy on the whole matter, a payment of money and this, that, the other thing, which Berlusconi then recently and illegally repudiated. Technically, sure, Libya could sue Italy at the International Court of Justice for genocide. So certainly the Italians are going to want to go in there and destroy that museum.
The Americans and Europeans seized Libya's assets abroad and have been dribbling them to their surrogates, their Libyan surrogates, ever since. Was anything legal in that ongoing operation?
No, it was just outright theft of the sovereign wealth of Libya and the Libyan people. There's no question about it. They had no authorization from the Security Council to do any of this. So just massive thievery by the United States and, again, these Western colonial imperial powers.
It's even speculated that the Europeans and possibly the United States might pay themselves back for all the bombs, the $1 billion it's cost them to invade Libya, by taking Libya's money.
Yeah, I mean, that's what they've done on Iraq, as you know. They destroyed Iraq and then said, well, don't worry about it. We can just get the money back from Iraq. But look, they already stole this money, and they're not going to give it back. They might give a small portion of it to the rebel government, but they're just going to steal it outright.
Dr. Francis Boyle, professor of international law, speaking from the University of Illinois. Before the Emancipation Proclamation, escaped slaves were accused of the crime of stealing themselves, their own bodies. In present-day Connecticut, a black mother is accused of stealing her own child's public school education. Attorney Darnell Crossland gives an update in the case of his client, Tanya McDowell.
What we have in this case is a person that's arrested and charged with a larceny, which is basically a theft charge. And what makes this case unique is that the thing that she's being accused of stealing is an education for a five-year-old son. When I say stealing an education, she enrolled her son in a school that the Board of Education said was impermissible because the mother did not live in that district. So it's an out-of-district enrollment is what the claim is. And what makes this particular case interesting is because this woman, by all indications, was homeless at the time, and she enrolled her child in the Norwalk Public Schools. And the Norwalk Public School has a policy that if, in fact, a child is found to be out of district, they simply disenroll the child, and they don't ask for any restitution, no incarceration, nothing penal. In this particular case, the prosecutor's office, by an urging of another attorney for the housing authority, arrested this woman, charged her with a 20-year larceny, and in the beginning was seeking restitution.
This sounds like some kind of vendetta.
Because I know the case intimately, I won't object to your characterization of vendetta, simply because there is some history there. But I would say, it, at very least, it's an unequal administration of justice, simply because when you have a lot of people, and most of them are women or families that are not of color, that simply get a slap on the wrist, they disenroll their child, and they go on about their business. And then when you have a woman of color like Ms. McDowell, who's now facing criminal charges, put in jail, they gave her a $20,000 bond, and she was living in a homeless shelter months preceding this. So bond is not supposed to be more high than necessary to assure your return to court, and they give her this extraordinary bond. So that was almost like a prison sentence itself. She pulled together a bunch of supporters. They made that bond. And so that's just the jump-off point. She was able to make that bond, but that starts to color this process. When you use the backdrop of the case in Ohio, another black woman who put her kid in the school district where the child's father lived just to avoid the gang violence or et cetera that was in her immediate district, she's arrested and put in jail for 9 days, I believe, and then now is on probation and may not be able to teach anymore in the future. It's just a heavy-handed administration of justice. And when you look at the numbers, it's being handed down against minority women.
Are the authorities trying to make her into some kind of example, a warning, stay away from our schools? And I put our in quotation marks.
That would not be a far-fetched conclusion to reach, simply because if, in fact, the penal justice system tries to deter others from doing certain things, they're going to send strong messages. We just object that the message should be sent to everybody, and the schools should be open to everybody, and everyone should have an opportunity of equal education.
And that brings up the point. You as a lawyer have an obligation to defend your client against the worst that the state can throw at her. But this also is a case in which you want to expand or at least clarify the rights of parents and children to an adequate public education.
Absolutely. The statistics and the numbers show that whenever you have inner cities abutting suburban areas, that you're going to have a lot of these type of cases simply because the people in the suburban areas don't want the inner city kids coming over that way. And they even have investigators that sit at train stations and see if people are jumping off trains and then going, dropping their kids off schools and then jumping back on the trains to head out. So it's a concerted effort to make sure that those people do not infiltrate these schools. And I think instead of doing that, we should make all schools equal and we wouldn't have to do that.
And many people might not know the lay of the land in Connecticut, which is considered a rich state comparatively, but whose cities are full of black and brown folk who are constrained basically to the limits of that jurisdiction.
Fairfield County is the county where this is happening, and Fairfield County, I think they say, is one of the richest counties per capita in the United States. Obviously, we have different cities that help those numbers rise, such as like Greenwich, Darien, New Canaan, where you have just, you know, the mega rich. But then you also have in that same county, you have the Norwalks, and Stanford is a mixed bag. But there's a lot of, like you said, black and brown people in those towns. And they're not afforded the same level of education as some of their counterparts.
And these rich cities are the ones in which the public schools are considered actually excellent public schools.
Well, Greenwich High School, you should use Greenwich for example. Greenwich High School is one of the best high schools probably in the country, and that's a public school. You have the benefit of a good public school education in Greenwich, but then you come up, like I said, to Norwalk, and Norwalk is still in Fairfield County, but you have two public schools, Norwalk High School and a school called Brian McMahon. Those schools pale in comparison to a Greenwich High School. And then when you go up to Bridgeport is largely minority, and the schools are low-level schools, they're failing schools, etc. And the child in our case was dragged out of a school that he was in Norwalk, which is an elementary school, and sent up to Bridgeport to go to school in a district that's largely failing.
So we have Ms. McDowell trying to cross that jurisdictional line, which is a line of income and other inequalities, vast inequalities, and facing prison time for doing it.
Exactly. And in the McDowell case, there's a federal law called McKinney-Vento Homeless Assistance Act. People on the street just call them McKinney-Vento. And what that says is that whenever a woman is homeless, or father for that matter, and has a young child, that father or mother could place that young child in any school of its choosing. And if there's ever a dispute as to whether, in fact, the mother is homeless or the father is homeless, then the child remains in the school until that dispute is sought out. And in direct contravention of federal law, this child was snatched out of school on a Friday without any information given to the mothers why this was happening, and then by Monday morning, this kid was without a school.
Are you proceeding on the federal level?
I made a motion to dismiss this case based on that, and I'm sad to say that the courts have been sidestepping a lot of these issues and not really giving us the opportunity to actually address these issues in a pretrial setting, stating that those are issues for trial. So that means that there's no dealing ahead of time unless you decide to go to trial and expose yourself to whatever risk comes along with a trial. But we're still pushing forward with these motions.
The school year has begun. Where is Tanya McDowell's child being educated today?
The child is being educated in Bridgeport. Ms. McDowell was incarcerated, which connects to that other point that you said, whether there was a vendetta. Ms. McDowell was living in the homeless shelter. There's a lot of drug activities going on around the homeless shelter for many, many years. And I would just put out there very lightly that the police officers on the drug task force in the town was interested in getting some information about drug activities, et cetera, and approached Ms. McDowell. She didn't want to play ball in terms of snitching or giving information, and then all of this stuff was hatched. There's some reason to believe there was some connection there. So that fits your vendetta word that I tabled earlier. But what I would suggest is that the listeners, the readers, the supporters reach out to Kevin Kane, who's a state's attorney in Connecticut, and he's the head state's attorney over all of the different towns, including Norwalk. I think the Norwalk court
is not the proper place for this case because the lead prosecutor is the daughter of the mayor, the stepdaughter of the mayor. The mayor has been very vocal in terms of what he thinks should happen to this woman. Therefore, the daughter is just like a hired gun in this particular case. I think the state's attorney should move this case to another area such as Bridgeport or maybe Stanford because it's very toxic where it is. And if your listeners could reach out to him, his number is 860-443-2835. And the address is 300 Corporate Place, Rocky Hill, Connecticut.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Greg Russ.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.